accession number 18750, reel 2.
Graham Scopes, reel 2.
We appeared to be pushing them back. We were clearing houses, and the Germans were backing off. But all around us, there was absolute chaos. There were, obviously, the rest of the battalion were fighting all around. There were armoured cars. By then, Arnhem had started to burn. There were armoured cars on fire. We could hear screams from the Germans trapped in them. And it really was quite chaotic then.
What did you think of the Germans as a soldierly force who were pitted against you?
They were good. There's no doubt about it. They were a good fighting force.
Did the civilians get mixed up in all this?
No. As far as I can recall, I cannot recall seeing a civilian during the actual fighting.
Were you able to eat and drink during this time?
Only what we carried with us. Water we did get from the houses, but we had no further. I had no further rations except what we carried with us, and that was on the fourth day.
Did you suffer because of the food and water situation?
Can't recall actually suffering, but obviously many did. But I can't personally recall suffering. Memory dims again. I can't even remember being hungry, but we obviously were.
Could you sleep?
Very little. Very little sleeping, indeed. After the fourth day, I was taken to one of the Red Cross centres, and for me, the battle was over. It was soon after that that Johnny, on the fifth or sixth day, things were getting, you know, obviously desperate. And Johnny Frost, I believe, surrendered his wounded. The battle wasn't finished, but he surrendered his wounded to the Germans, of which I was one of them.
What had happened to you before that at the Red Cross Centre?
Oh, we were just lying there. We must have had some. We must have had some sort of food there because I was there for a day and a night. I just can't remember eating, but we must have done. And then the Germans came through. When Johnny Frost surrendered, and we were taken to the main square in Arnhem, and we were laid in stretchers on the square. And the chap who was lying next to me was a Lieutenant McDermott. He had the most ghastly a stick, one of these stick grenades, had obviously burst in his face, and he was his stretcher. I was there. His stretcher was lying next door to me, but I now know that he died before he was taken to hospital.
Were you able to communicate with each other?
With McDermott? No. He was groaning all the time. As a matter of fact, Lieutenant Greyburn, who was still on his feet but wounded, wanted to shoot McDermott. He was in such, you know, it was so hopeless, and he was in such ghastly pain, but he didn't. Now, Greyburn was eventually killed.
Oh.
And he got the... I don't know, but he was posthumously awarded the VC.
Why do you think he didn't shoot him?
I just don't know. I suppose he had second thought, and McDermott did die, I now know, very, very shortly afterwards.
How did you know McDermott's name?
I do know. I can't recall. Oh, I think there was another walking wounded by me, Roberts. He was one of the war, and I think he told me, Lieutenant Roberts.
How much pain were you in?
Not a great deal. Not a great deal of pain. It was a clear... it was an ache, and I did lose a lot of blood, and I was quite weak. But I can't recall any searing pain. And then we were taken to, I think it was a Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Arnhem. But that you'll be able to check. And before we went to the hospital, we were seen by a German doctor, and his operating gown was covered in blood, and he looked at me. And, you know, obviously decided he could do nothing. My arm was there. All he did was put another fresh dressing on my wound. And that's how it was. That was how it was left until I returned to the UK. It healed. The wound healed, obviously, but the arm was absolutely. I had to lift my arm all the time. It was absolutely useless.
How did the Germans treat you at first?
I personally hadn't... There were some atrocities in Arnhem, but as far as I was concerned, I was treated as a... within the Geneva Convention, as a prisoner of war. I had no brutality at all.
How did you know there were some atrocities?
Reading reports afterwards. I don't know whether this is relevant to the interview, but there was one truck of prisoners being taken to a compound where I think one of the officers tried to escape, and the Germans turned their guns on the rest of the occupants of the wagon. And I believe that who was responsible for that atrocity was eventually brought to justice. I believe so.
What do you remember happening to you next?
Well, I was in this hospital in a ward with mostly German wounded. And once again, I must say I was treated extremely well. When the equivalent to the German naffy came round with bottles of this and little luxury, I was given a bottle of Advocar by the German officer who was distributing these goodies. And then my prison life started to do a most peculiar turn. I wasn't sent directly to Sagan. I was taken, and once again, I cannot remember where, to a convalescent home. It was over the border. I was taken by truck, and it was quite a long way. I'm certain it was in Germany, where there were some American Air Force people, and there was... And another officer from the airborne, I don't even know what battalion, he was badly wounded and he died there. And we were in this little convalescent home for about a fortnight.
What treatment did you get there?
Excellent, good. Food was very reasonable. There was a lot of bombing in the area, and I do recall that by that time. My wound had, you know, reasonably healed. The arm was still absolutely immobile, but we were detailed to go to the funeral of two aircrew that had been brought down, American aircrew that had been brought down locally. And then once again, the most peculiar thing happened. I was, it was... because I couldn't speak German, it was decided that I should now leave this convalescent home and go to a prison camp. Now, it was myself and two German guards took me from this convalescent home to Berlin, and from Berlin, before we took them, we went on the Berlin, I think it must have been the Berlin Metro. The guard stopped for coffee and whatever in a station canteen. And I was sitting on the floor, and by that time, I'd acquired a green inner jacket of an airman, you know, with the electrical wires. And I wasn't offered any coffee, of course, but while the Germans were having their coffee, a girl came in and started talking to the German guard and looked at me, and she did spit at me. That was the only, you know, anti-English behavior I encountered. Anyhow, we got on, we eventually got to the main station, and we got on this train, obviously heading for, as I now know, Sagan. During the journey, we were stopped two or three times. The Americans, I can't quite remember the type of aircraft, used to strafe the trains, and we were bundled out into the sidings, into the grass sidings, and until the attacks, you know, we laid there until the attacks had finished. I suppose there were chances of escaping, but I was weak, with lack of food, loss of blood, with a gammy arm, and I really, terrible thing to say, I really hadn't got the spirit to make a run for it. And the journey continued, and we were taken to where I now know was Sagan. And there I met up with Barringer, my old sergeant, and quite a lot of other they were mostly airborne. There were a few South African, Afrikaan troops, prisoners there, who got on extremely well with the Germans because of their Dutch and German upbringing. Things went, food got terribly short there. But by then, Red Cross parcels were at the very minimum. I think the Germans themselves were short of food. We did, we had a very thin skilly, you know, and brown bread and acorn coffee. On the odd occasion, whether this was true or not, but on the odd occasion, we did get a little bit of white meat. And the rumour was that when a Russian died, it was he that we were possibly eating. But that was that. Whether that was just camp nonsense, I don't know. But it was most extraordinary. We had this thin skilly, you know, with just a few beans, peas, not a sign of meat. And then suddenly, a skilly would come up with some white meat in it. But as I say, that was just a. Whether it was just camp gossip, I don't know.
Did you eat this meat?
Oh, yes, dude. Yeah, absolutely, yes. Because we were, and we were, you know, by then we were fairly lousy. We had no change of clothing, and we were in a pretty manky state, to be quite honest. Well, I can't remember length of time, but came a morning when we were all assembled, and obviously, our representatives, camp representatives who dealt with the German on our behalf, English people, prisoners. And it came about that we were going to be moved. We had no idea where or why or what, but we were assembled one early morning. We were clothed with what we stood up in, nothing else, and we were marched. We were on the road. Now there were some. They were fairly tough with the Germans. Anybody that really lagged behind, once again, I didn't personally see it, but there were stragglers shot.
What condition were you in to undertake this march?
Poor condition. And there were a lot of people died naturally on the, or were left to die on the march. But the only thing that really kept a lot of us going, we were extremely well trained, we were healthy and very, very fit young man prior to the campaign, and that obviously stood us in good fettle. We stopped at farmhouses on the way, and on two occasions we were in, because winter had started to, winter was beginning then, September, October time. And we were in barns with, I can well remember on two occasions, we were with sheep. Sheep were just barricaded off from us, and we were bedded down in straw in this barn with the sheep, which stunk terribly. And we were marched for, once again, time. It's terribly difficult to say how long we were on the march, but I understand it was a 500-mile march down to the Western Front. And I believe the camp we eventually arrived at via Dresden was Bad Orb. I believe it was. But I'm quite certain records will, you'll better find out what camp it was.
You told me earlier off the record that you didn't actually go through Dresden.
No, we didn't. We skirted Dresden. We skirted Dresden. We didn't go through the actual town. But we could see that there was still smoke coming from it. It was after the devastation. But we didn't go through right through the town. We went through the outskirts of the town.
Any incidents that happened to you on this march?
Not personally, no. No, no. We just trudged on and on and on.
Did you realise the purpose of this?
Yeah, it was to get us away. Why, I don't know, but the Germans didn't want us to fall in the hands of the Russians.
What would you have preferred to have happened?
With hindsight, I think probably the march was the better option, because I don't think the Russians were terribly difficult, even with Allied prisoners.
So you arrived at this Bad Orb place.
Yes.
Where was this, in Bavaria or somewhere?
I don't think it was down on the west side of Germany, but once again I can't recall. I suppose one should have made notes of all this, but I didn't. And we waited there, and we were eventually liberated by. There was a lot of air activity around the camp. Allied aircraft, and eventually the Americans fought their way in.
What's happened to you at liberation?
Ah, well, all those that were, the efficiency of the Americans were excellent. They put down a delousing unit, they brought us donuts and ice cream was coming up. And within 2 days, they sorted out all those that were wounded. And we were the first. We were flown out of the camp after about 3 or 4 days after being deloused and after being given some American gear, shirt, trousers, and an American jacket.
What's happened to the guards at the camp?
They'd gone. By then, we could have marched out ourselves. But we were advised not to, because they told us there could easily be German skirmishing on the outskirts. They told us, you know, be sensible, stay put until the Americans organized a proper outing of the camp.
What condition were you in by the time you were liberated?
Pretty, you know, we were, I personally, with, I started off as about 12 and a half to 13 stone, and when I came out, I was 7 stone when I got back to England.
What was your height?
I was 5'9".
Was anything done for you on arrival in England?
No, oddly enough, no, there wasn't. We were given, we arrived at High Wycombe, we were given a red berry, which I still got, and a rail pass to wherever we, my father was working in those days, his business had folded due to the war, and he was working as a manager for Wimpy's, and they had a housing site at Denham in Buckinghamshire. I knew that because my last leave was there. It was a chalet type for all the people who were working for Wimpy's at that time, and I made my way there, and when I got there, my father had gone. He had left Wimpy's, but there was people who knew me, knew my name, and I was bedded down for the night there, and Wimpy's, they knew where my father had gone, which was Worcester Park, and Wimpy's laid on a car and took me to Worcester Park. I had a cousin, and I was there, you know, recuperating in bed. No, there was some talk about reporting for medical treatment. But before that happened, my this is another silly little story. My cousin was had a boyfriend who was Colonel Croft, who was managing director of Wandsworth Gasworks before nationalisation. It was a private. Before nationalisation and before privatisation took place recently, and he knew a surgeon at Hammersmith Hospital. His name was Professor Richard Franklin, and Colonel Croft obviously got in touch with the army authorities and obviously chatted to his chum Professor Franklin, and I was taken to a military ward, or I made my way to Hammersmith Hospital in Duquesne Road. There was a military ward there, Ward 7. I was put in there, and arrangements had obviously had been made with the army authorities that all was well. And Professor Franklin, it was about a 7-hour operation. He did a suture of what nerves he could, and my arm recovered out of all recognition. I can move it, and as I can today. The only thing he couldn't do, one part of the nerve, which operates this part of the hand, that could never be repaired. So I was left with a limp, a drop, what they call a drop
wrist.
And it was in Duquesne Hospital that I met Marjorie, who was a staff nurse there. And eventually, I was in hospital for about 6 months.
Apart from the drop wrist, did you make a full recovery?
Absolutely. Everything else went. I've got a scar, you know, right around there. They opened me up there, and my collarbone, they had to break, which I've got a lump there. But apart from this wrist, I made almost 100% recovery.
Were there any after effects of having been at Arnhem and having been a POW?
Yes, there were. I couldn't sleep very well. During my hospital treatment, it was fine. I had no thought or repercussions at all. When I got out of hospital, I started to have odd nightmares. I could see this chap standing on the stairs that shot me. I jumped at any odd bang, I used to leap and jump about. But that eventually, after a comparatively short time, that started to disappear. And I must admit, I haven't suffered any real repercussions of the war. I think of old chums that were lost, you know, and I still go to reunions. I'm still in touch with quite a lot of chums. I'm a committee member of the Para 2 Club, which was the remnants of the old 2nd Battalion Parachute Regiment. We meet once a year at Grantham for a weekend where we drink beer and reminisce. And that's still going on, and I should be going there again in 1999 in May for another reunion.
Did your period of contact with the Germans during the Second World War change your attitude towards Germans and Germany?
No, it didn't. I mean, they obviously they were swine the way they treated the Jews, but the ordinary soldier, I have no complaints with at all, Conrad. They treated me as a prisoner of war should be treated. No kid glove treatment, but they behaved properly.
How do you feel like now in 1999 about having served in the Second World War?
It is something that I would not have missed. Something that I would not have missed.
Why do you say that?
I think it brought, you know, I was 18 when war broke out. I'd led a fairly sheltered life, you know, a comfortable middle-class life. My father had his own business. I worked for my father for all my work in life up to the beginning of war, which wasn't very long. It broadened my whole outlook, and I feel I'm a wholer person by going through the war.
Just going back to something you said to me earlier about having been in a convalescent home in Germany, what kind of facilities did they have there?
Better food, rest. And that really was all. It's one of those. I wish I could remember more, or why. It was all the people in there had been wounded and were recovering. But why they sought me out to go there, I don't know. And why I was picked to be taken individually from the outskirts of Holland and Germany, way up to Upper Silesia, I don't know, and I don't suppose I shall ever know.
As you were crossing Germany, did you see anything of the damage done by the bombing?
A little bit, as I from the what I believe was a metro in the underground in Germany to the main station. Yeah, there was a little bit of yes, I did see some bomb sites.
Was that in Berlin?
In Berlin.
But did, apart from that girl who spat on you, did the civilians ignore you?
Ignored me.